So we continue continuation, the Bhakti Trilogy by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core. Delineations on the esoterics of pure devotion. So we're looking at the different ways. We are today discussing the shower, the third shower of nectar from the Marhuya Kandambini. Kandambini emphasizes the alignment of clouds. In Marhuya, the clouds, with the idea is extinguishing the blazing forest fire of material attraction, of material attachments, etc. As the clouds are showering the Marhuya, showering the love, showering the devotion. So we look at what is bhakti, its different manifestations. We're looking at things that act as obstructions to bhakti. We were discussing yesterday about the different areas that causes distress. So we can look a little closer at what causes us to undergo different types of distress. And so Vishwanath Chakravarti mentioned about the factor of nescience, or this lack of knowledge and understanding. Where there is anger, there's envyousness, where there is hatred, where there's attachments and gross attachments, even to the point of one feeling disturbed about death because they want to have more material sense gratification, the last level of attachment. And then we looked a little bit at, as we move through those things rather quickly, lots of details, sort of breeze through some of it. And as we also address that there are different types of sins. Just a brief update. Four types of sins, the prarabdha, those are sins that have already matured, aprarabdha, sins that have not matured, we have not experienced the effects yet. And then the bijam, or the seed, and the kuta, or the bija, is where the sin has not matured, has not even manifested, but the seed is there. Sinful desires and meditations, reflections, they're there. And then the kuta, or even before the seed is firmly planted, certain improper mindsets, desires, and other things that create an atmosphere that plants the seed. And once that seed is planted, it's like a time bomb. Once it's there, now it can be ignited, it can cause all kinds of confusion. So that seed is planted, been watered, been nourished, and then there's trouble. So we were trying to nourish the Bhakti Lata Bija. And we want to avoid all the Mishra Bijas. Karma Mishra, the Jnana Mishra, the Yoga Mishra, etc. So these great souls are helping us to know how to clear up. And it's important when we see historically and presently so many things that people need to clear up so they can be happy in the devotional process, experience the deeper levels of the culture, and then be able to distribute and share that. Otherwise, it's like, again, having the medicine. It has all the prescriptions, everything is prescribed there properly. But then, it's not working, because where it does not work for one, it's due to the lack of proper following. And where we embrace it and take it effectively, directly, then we avoid so many complexities, social complexities, individual complexities, so many things. So today we're going to look at the anarthas. Yesterday we were looking at Vajana Kriya. As one now, the devotional seed is there, Shraddha, faith is taking place, Sadhu Sangha, association. Hopefully quality association, and then from the association, one gets inspired to go on in engaging in the devotional process. And now we're looking at, okay, what happens as we go forward. So then we, of course, come to Anartha Nivritti. So this starts our discussion today on the third shower of nectar. So you look at the Anarthas, Anartha Nivritti. This chapter discusses Anartha Nivritti, the cessation of unwanted desires. We break that down to Anartha means unwanted desires in the heart, and Nivritti means to cease. So things in the heart, remember bhakti is always about the heart. So where bhakti is not properly executed, it means some contamination is there in the heart. That is causing obstruction, obfuscation. And when the bhakti is pouring out unconditionally, great vibrance, then we understand that the obstructions are not there. And so his natural presence is coming forward. So, four different types of obstructions we'll talk about today, which are the Nivrittis, or brings seizing of the bhakti, procrastinates the bhakti, covers it up, and in some cases, practically extinguishes. So the first case is called Duskritotha, anarthas coming from sinful activities. So remember the different types of sins. Anarthas coming from the sinful stuff. Another type is called Sukratotha, anarthas coming from pious deeds. Now that sounds a little confusing. How can you have anarthas coming from pious deeds? We normally think of pious deeds, something extremely wonderful. It should be very fulfilling, satisfying, uplifting. But see, as we look at devotional service, we must constantly remind ourselves, we're not dealing with just a moment. We're constantly dealing with what we did, who we were, what environments we were connected with, how we use or abuse those situations from previous lives. The soul is eternal. So we are appearing in this stage and that stage like a play. So Act 1, Act 2, Act 3. So we may be looking at Act 3 or Act 1 million bodies, the soul that we're now in. But the soul, the same identity, has been going through these things. And so we're carrying all that stuff in different ways. Some patterns of it, some residue. That's also why interpersonal relationships are quite difficult. Because when we're dealing with any individual, we're really dealing with many, many personalities, or many aspects of personalities combined together, making a dominant personality now. It's like sometimes someone is having some problem in their life, and they have some kind of phobia that's kind of irrational. They're just terribly horrified of fire, or they're terribly frightened by height, or by encasement, claustrophobia, whatever. So sometimes these things are very prevalent and dominant in the present consciousness because of some connection from previous life. It's like in cases where maybe someone left the body in the last lifetime or lifetime or two back. And they left the body, they were pushed off or they jumped off or they fell off a tall cliff, a mountain, a building. So in their subtle consciousness, they're having some great anxiety about heights, which they can't quite understand. Or somebody has this tremendous phobia of snakes. It's so irrational. Even just see a picture of a snake, they get chills, they get nervous, they become afraid, they cry. And so they find that some distinct pattern is there that's coming forward in this lifetime. So they were bit by a snake, the suffering. And so there are some impressions. So it's very hard. For instance, for modern sociologists and psychologists, psychiatrists to deal with people's issues, because they can't understand the influence on previous lives, nor can they really understand fully the influence from the earlier part of even of this life. They don't understand the gradually getting some, a few people getting some knowledge of the impact on this, on the embryo in the womb. But so much is already there, etc. Now, when we look at bhakti, we also, just like one of the expressions we discussed yesterday, is when one has something like shadow enthusiasm. And so, initially, we're very excited, a certain kind of enthusiasm. It even presents a certain pride. Oh, I am a Hare Krishna devotee. One feels very proud and condescending toward others. One has pride in different ways. That's unhealthy. But it's part of the process of maturation, excitement, anticipation. And later one has to really process these things a little more. Or one is trying to stop doing certain things, but one is vacillating back and forth because they really don't have so much faith. So their doubts are stronger than their faith. And so we were discussing yesterday how that slows down the creeper. It causes bhakti devi to hide. Or one has strong faith, but even though they have some faith and they have intelligence, understand that something is wrong, but then they still find themselves miserably engaging in the sinful thing, even though they know it's wrong. But they're not at a phase yet where they have that greater knowledge with strength. And so, all of these different stages we see is the experience as one is trying to engage in the process. As we tried to look a little closer at some of them yesterday. So now we look at this Anartha Nivritti and explore closer what are these four categories and how they interfere, how they cause the heart not to be able to express its experience its highest expressions. So coming from sinful activities, that's the first case. Some things that keep haunting us and are still unfolding because it's parabaha. That is, it's things that we haven't fully paid the dues for yet. Just like we as Vaishnavas, it may seem to be harsh in one way when it comes to punishment. Dealing with several issues now about punishment, about people doing things wrong and people should apologize, they should be punished. But sometimes it seems a little harsh because we honor capital punishment. Somebody takes someone's life, we honor the fact that person's life should be taken. Now, avant-garde thinkers see this as totally improper. Of course, nowadays it's very risky because the legal systems are not proper. Executive systems are not proper. So to try to put ideal laws with so many other things, then there'll be problems because so many people do go to jail or so many people are in prison and people are on death row who really were framed or didn't really do it. And so the idea of then having automatic capital punishment for those who are proven to be guilty when so many times the situation is flawed is actually dangerous. But normally capital punishment is recommended because so that person can be free of the suffering in that lifetime. Otherwise they have to pay for that. In the next lifetime, two lifetimes later or whatever, they're going to have to pay. They killed somebody, they're going to have to pay for that. It doesn't just fly away, it doesn't go away. They'll be forgiven, but they have to pay for it. So sometimes, some things that are happening to us now, we can't even understand why. We're trying to do everything nicely at this point. We're trying so many ways. And we may wonder, why I keep having this problem and that problem? Sometimes it's due to some heavy stuff from the past. There's that one discussion of Prabhupada with one Indian gentleman who was quite offensive to Prabhupada in his arguments and whatnot, and his mood. And Prabhupada very tactfully said one day, I must have done something to him in a previous life. Because that's Prabhupada's humility. But it shows how Vaishnavas also can think from time to time. Vaishnava should be very tolerant about things to him or herself. But to others, no. That we see that even the pure devotees don't even accept offenses. Even if you do offensive things to them. But it's held against the person. Because the Lord in the heart doesn't just take it off lightly like that. But they themselves, they just feel, oh, I deserve this. Decided I did something in a previous life. Or how unfortunate that I have caused you anxiety. Like when Brigham Muni kicked Lord Vishnu. Instead of Lord Vishnu saying, oh, you'll never kick anybody again. I'll break that foot and the other foot also. No. He was in the mood of, oh, I'm sorry you must have hurt your foot on my chest. The mentality of a devotee is very unusual and cannot be understood through these orthodox means. And that's why if someone is really entering into following like this, or someone has become evolved, it is very dangerous in how we interact, because we must be careful not to make the aparads. And that is the third case. Aparad hota. Anarthas coming from offenses. So now, keep in mind, first one, anarthas coming from sinful activities. And that can be past or present. Parabadha, of the past, aparabadha from that have not come about yet. So we got all this stuff happening, which is dynamic in one sense. Scary in the sense that everything is being recorded, in the sense everything is going to give some reciprocation. Unfortunately, if there's some stuff in the closet, there's some deviant stuff, there's some sinful thing, then it's going to catch up on one. But fantastic in that whatever investments, devotion, whatever good actions, words, thoughts, that all of that also is going to produce various things. Some things immediately and some things later in the future. It's not really that someone just somehow gets some unusual good fortune. It's something, usually some build-up. Someone gets a boon, so there's something happening based on the karma factor. Just recently, there a big problem in England. One of the heads of the head of this football team or something, soccer team, football team for the country. People wanted him to step down because he had a little insight in Vedic culture, and he spoke some words of wisdom. But it was powerful and was not understood, and it was delicate. And he spoke about how everything is based on karma. And so people got furious. Handicapped, they campaigned against him. Government had to actually take him out of his post. People were attacking him. How can you say? Somebody is blind. Someone is crippled in his lifetime. This, that, that. And it's something that they've done in the previous life. How can you do that? And they ate the guy up. He had to step down. And the worst thing is that because people's sentiment, they don't understand these sciences. Then people start campaigning in so many circles. And what it really came down to, it came down to attacking the basic whole doctrine of karma and reincarnation. In a country where, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are from Indian background and backgrounds and philosophical and religious backgrounds, where it's an integral part of their knowledge and understanding. So I think in this month's, this coming Hare Krishna World, we're having an article on that to address such things. But there should have been more coming forward of people who understand and can explain it, and so that is also not seen to be harsh. I mean, it comes off harsh if you just say, well, you know, somebody's little kid got hit by a car. You say, well, it's just karma. People think, well, what's wrong with you crazy Hare Krishna people? What do you mean? You have no love, you have no sympathy, you have no affection for that little mother, kid and her mother. So, it's not just expressed so harshly in such way, but it cannot be understood. But at the same time, how can it be anything except that? Because if we accept anything other than that, then you accept that there is no God, or that God is not controlling, or He has no laws, or that Maya is greater, or that Krishna can't really keep in charge of his kingdom. It's overwhelming for him. He can't keep up. So he's messing things up. So we hear that, well, it's karma. We can think this and understand it. We still have to deal with the actual issues at hand. We can say somebody is born in poverty. Somebody is born with deformity. First, it's not necessarily something bad. Because sometimes one's fortune is that they're born, they don't have so many material things to distract him in his lifetime. But in general, we see some representations of, like a better word, bad karma. It's legal problems in his lifetime, chronic disease, lack of education, lack of beauty, etc. These are some general signs. But when you see these things, it doesn't necessarily mean categorically that, your sin has caught up with you. Just like sickness, everybody gets sick. Everybody dies. Legal problems, well, there's a general tendency that if there's so much litigation, that is one of the signs of some karmic influence. So we can understand these things maturely and be able to approach issues with that knowledge in the background. But if we just say, well, somebody fell down the steps. It's your karma, Prabhu. Better hope you don't have a lot more coming. You may fall even harder next time. So somebody falling on it, hit their head, and you're at the top of the steps thinking, you got some heavy karma. First, how would you feel if you're in that situation? Somebody's addressing you like that. You say, whoa, you got some heavy karma. Did you break your arm or your leg? So, but at the same time, we do understand that underlining all things is some real uniformity. Some reciprocity situations are taking place. So, that means we have to be so careful about what we do. Somebody now, they're barren, and they're in just total anxiety. There are people who commit suicide or wish they were dead because they cannot have an issue. In some of those cases, only last lifetime, they were boarding all over the place. Krishna gave them so many souls to take care of that they called for. And they kept refusing them, eliminating them. And so now in this lifetime, they really want a child like anything, more than anything in their life. And they just cannot have. And so, yes, it is some karmic situation is there. But only to address it like that, and only to let it stay like that. Because even when there is such issues, one still tries to help and tries to provide, but then it's karma, whether or not it is going to be effective or not. So it's a delicate thing, and sometimes people, they get disturbed. Sometimes the Christians, they get disturbed about Eastern things. And one of the reasons they bring this up, about the idea of karma. But then they don't realize that if they don't accept it, they're almost like atheists. Because they don't accept that God is really controlling everything in the ultimate scheme of things. Due to all kinds of amalgamations and permutations of karma. Some bank gets robbed. So why that bank got robbed instead of 1,000 other banks? Why that bank, a teller, happened to be there and got shot and the other thousands didn't? It's also some karmic thing. Dynamic of the person who owned the bank, person who was in the bank, person who robbed the bank. In all these cases, it is some karmic connections that are manifesting due to such. So what a fantastic world in the sense of how Krishna is really on the scene, controlling in so many ways, and how everyone is accountable. And we may cheat here, we may deviate, we may abuse, we may do this, and we're going to get some results based on that. You are harsh and cruel to someone, you're going to get it back in some ways. The beauty, if you are kind, you're considerate, you're thoughtful, you're going to get it, you're going to receive that in so many ways. So how much more than people should be sensitive and being able and being eager to do the right thing, whatever is going on. Or whatever somebody says to you or does to you, how important it is for you to do the right thing, so you don't get caught up in the negative karma that others may experience. It's like one thing that hurts our movement in these times more and more is devotees make offenses toward each other. And what's even worse is that one person gets offended, and then that person, instead of taking higher bhakti and defeating that in such a way, then makes an offense, this person makes an offense, and then everybody suffers from that. It's like people ending a fight, four or five people. So one person throws a blow. Then somebody else goes and they get the hammer and they get the hammer. And somebody gets a brick and somebody gets a stick. And you look at them, they're all bruised up. And they're all brothers and sisters. Huh? And then the mother comes in. She says, "What's going on?" And the big brother says, "Well, I didn't throw the first punch, but I surely threw the second one." And then the little cousin says, "And I came in. And I started talking to them, and then they bumped into me, and I let them know they're going to bump into me again. I took the chair and smashed them in the head." And then there's people thinking, "I'm right and I'm right." It's craziness. Complete craziness. So Maya finds so many ways to distract the neophyte. Maya finds so many ways to occupy one from really dealing with the real issues at hand. And I'm always going. Because it's Maya's duty to do that, to see where the bhakti really is. It's Maya's duty to do that, to make the arrangement so Bhakti Devi can stay away or can come. So Maya says, "Bhakti Devi, don't go there. Those persons, that environment, they're not ready for you." Maya's actually working for Krishna. That same Maya says, "Well, I test them like anything. They didn't even open up to let me come in. So go ahead, Bhakti Devi. No place for me there. I'll go bother somebody else." Krishna consciousness is so simple if we are genuine. But we have so many issues. You're going to find so many things to lose faith on, so many things to make offenses, so many things to get distracted, so many things to doubt the great acharyas, so many things to doubt Krishna. And Maya will say, "Okay, from what you brought in before, from what you're processing now, This is where you're at. So many, many more lifetimes. I'll keep working on you. And then maybe one lifetime, you may decide to run away from me. And I'll be happy, even though I'm grabbing you and beating you. I want you to run away, but you keep coming, so I'm going to keep beating you. So it is so wonderful when you think Krishna in the heart, he's watching over everything. Krishna has so many, many agencies there. And everything we do, that Lord knows our intent, our consciousness. He knows where our stuff is, and has given us the ability to move to the anarthas. As we're reading now, Vishwanath Chakravarti being used to explain such things. But then people read and read and read, but they don't do it. But it just goes right to the mind, to someone else's mind. It doesn't really register, other than just some philosophical discourse. Because you wonder, the way so many people act, do they read? Huh? Sometimes you wonder, are people reading? If they are reading, then how can they act in that way? And in some cases, they are reading, and they have so much stuff from previous life, and so many heavy things from this lifetime, that it's got them bound. Just like we were discussing yesterday, there's that level where you can know what is right and still can't act on what is right. Because unless there's sufficient association, proper association to stimulate that is known, one still will not be able to act upon it. And that's why one must genuinely have greed to seek after higher association. Anybody who says you shouldn't seek after higher association, they're in another movement, another philosophy. But we must have an understanding of what higher association is. We must do everything with a sense of compassion and a sense of care. Otherwise, what little flame is there, it will not get ignited and it will not grow. You put the seed in the ground, that's just the beginning. Now you have to water it and you have to nourish it. You have to protect it and protect it. And as the plants start growing, the animals and other things begin to notice it, and it becomes more of at a threat. So it has to be guarded very carefully in its early stages. Otherwise, the rats, the deers, the peacocks, everything will just eat the plant away, as they sometimes do. So it's planting it. There's only one aspect. Now the real thing is once it is there, nurturing it. And then later it can be harvested. So there are these sins, the anarthas that's blocking the bhakti in the heart from the past. There are those from pious deeds. Now pious deeds also have to do with the past. Pious deeds mean sometimes things that people have done, gotten some punya, some boons, and it gives them some facility for sense gratification. Those can be anarthas. So because of some piety, you get wealth. Some piety, you get so many opportunities for engaging your senses. You get certain opulences. You do some pious deeds. And then one can get so preoccupied in such things that then that becomes an anartha. Some people who are rich, and they're very rich from piety from previous lifetime. For some of them, that richness, that wealth, is now their greatest enemy. Because it distracts them. It causes them not to take shelter of simplicity, of spiritual life. It causes them not to depend on God because they're kind of powerful themselves. Then it's borrowing them within their own range or environment. And so that wealth that was acquired from previous piety now has become their greatest enemy. Some other people, they're wealthy like anything. And due to that wealth, they find so many ways now. They have more time to do their devotion, more time to support devotional things. They build temples, they make arrangements, they do so many things. Sometimes you see that with some, like Indian, very pious Vaishnava, the businessmen. Some of them are so wealthy. But when you meet them, they're so humble, They do two or three hours of puja every day, huh? An hour and a half before they go to work, 2 or 3 hours at night when they come back. You go to the office, they get pictures of Krishna, huh? You go there, and they don't smoke, they don't drink, they take intoxications, they're honest. So sometimes you find like that. It's rare, but sometimes you find like that. And you realize, oh, so this person is not only great in this life, they've been great in the previous life, and they are using the material things they have in a way to enhance the devotion, rather than that being a obfuscation for their spiritual life. So there's these areas from piousness from the past that can happen both ways, but it can cause anarthas, stagnations. Then the aprahodha, anarthas coming from offenses. So we know the category of offenses. So we have the namaparad for some of the worst, and the dharmaparad, offenses in the tirthas, which are many times magnified. Huh? People make offenses in the holy dhams, they suffer like anything. I've seen some cases of people who chronic disease for the rest of their life, or they bloop, or they have something constantly trailing them, and then you study, you realize it's because of offenses in the holy dhamma that's magnified 100 or 1,000 times, etc. Why some little thing keeps following them and hunting them because of offenses in the holy dhamma. This is why sometimes people were recommended not to visit more than 3 days in these holy places. You're not in the right consciousness. But then, again, you take the converse of that. You go to the holy dhams, which is a integral tenet of what our existence is supposed to be about. We're supposed to have great greed and eagerness, have tremendous aspirations to live in holy places. One of our tenets of executing devotional service. And so if we can't physically live there, we must constantly be having a mindset of connecting or reflecting about such holy places. But at the same time, these holy places can kill us. They can stagnate the creeper, or they can hurt one like anything if one comes so close and acts so improperly. So this again, Krishna calling everyone to be accountable. So I give you my darshan, the holy place. I give you a chance to come to such tirthas. Then the question is, now, are you going to honor it, embrace it, take advantage of it, grow with it? Or are you going to bring same kind of stuff from lifetime after lifetime of trying to cheat? You're going to come so close to still try to engage in sense gratification. Try to use the dham for sense gratification. And people do that. And doesn't matter whether it's Vrindavan or Rishikesh or Hardwar, whether it's Jerusalem or whether it's Mecca. Many people go to the holy dhams, do business, do drugs, do prostitution. Crime, organized crime. Every holy dham practically on the planet now is organized crime. So Maya has become very heavy. But now, just as we were discussing 2 days ago, according to the quality of the person, when they go to the environment, determines what they pick up. Somebody goes to Vrindavan, and all they see is poverty. Somebody goes to bathe in the Jamuna, and all they see is dirty water. Someone else goes, and even before they even touch the water, that they are just totally exhilarated and reflecting on this wonderful opportunity to be able to bathe in such holy river. And even before they do the physical bathing, they've already bathed because so much of their consciousness is associated with the environment. So in both cases, the same thing. But it is perceived and codified differently. And we can't blame Krishna. This is in the wrestling match. The same Krishna, but people saw him differently according to their consciousness, according to what kind of anarthas, fears, sins they were involved in, or according to how much they were free of such things. Krishna and Balaram, they made themselves available, but it's according now to ourselves of how we make ourselves available, and then we connect with a certain aspect of the Lord. So Vishwanath is making it very clear. So there's distinct things that causes some of these diseases. Now the danger is the people are reading such, hearing such, discussing such. Such things are available. When they hear it, and then they make a continual offenses based on such, it's even worse. Just like, for instance, what we do in the Holy Dhams is magnified. We get many, many credits, benefits when something's done nice, something's done improper. We suffer so much. And what does it say? If we're in the Holy Dhams and we're reading and discussing and having classes, having seminars, having workshops, and having VIT programs, when we're hearing such stuff and then we still act improper, oh, when one gets chastised, it's heavy. So it is dangerous to know and not to act. It's very dangerous. Now more and more our devotees are knowing all over the world. We have so many books. We have so many tapes. We have so much when you're talking about pastimes of Prabhupada and so many literatures. And we have so many people writing books, really nice things. So many wonderful seminars. Now, when people are being exposed to more and more and they do not act upon it, there is greater suffering. And that's why some devotees are so depressed. Some devotees are suicidal. Because the more you hear, the more you expose to, and if you don't act upon it, then it means there is heavier consequence. Krishna consciousness is wonderful. It is extremely powerful and extremely dangerous. We do not embrace it and use it properly. Just like we understand, if a Brahmin makes an offense, it's worse than a devotee first initiation, or it's worse. Or if a bhakti makes an offense, it's not as bad as an initiated devotee. So the more the one is supposedly a part of the blessings of the culture of devotion, the more one is supposed to be more of a carrier of it. When they do not do that, it is actually greater. And this is why the scripture says, if a sannyasi falls down, better he commits suicide. Inasmuch as that you're going to come to that level where you're representing the system and you are being honored and respected based on that as a carrier, and you deviate, then what you're going to deal with karmically, it would practically be better that you take your own life so that you are freed from some of the stuff that you're going to have to deal with. It's going to follow you. Notice most of sannyasis in our movement who fall down, they leave. Huh? In other words, the karmic reaction is so heavy that most of them cannot get their footing, even to the point of being able to participate in the process, in this lifetime, in a healthy way. And those who somehow keep trying to go, they are very special. That somehow, in spite of taking humble pie and trying, but you better believe that it is hell for them. Huh? Even for the few who stay around and try to go on their devotional service, almost every day is like hell for them. Because you don't play games with Krishna. You don't accept some position. You don't accept being accountable for people and being caretaking of people and then abuse that, or your life becomes a big lie, what you're trying to tell people, and you're living a big lie, and think that Krishna just says, oh, it is just okay. Maya says, you are in my camp, and therefore I deal with you as need be. As you are not properly protected, that you are doing things that has brought you to my camp, and therefore I deal with you. And so it is very dangerous. It is very bad, even when someone has heard this knowledge and then goes into Maya. What can they do? Every time they do some sin, the intelligence beats them like anything. Whatever pleasure they get, temporary pleasures, the suffering that comes after that, because they know is completely hellish. It is very harsh that we have so many people who are in the knowledge and can't follow, or were not willing to follow. It's like we should be sad to know that one of our brothers or sisters, nieces and nephews, aunties and uncles, is in like a very, very devastating situation. You hear the person is living in the streets, eating out of garbage cans. It's extreme. You think, oh, that's my cousin, that's my uncle, that's my niece. You think, oh, the person is running around like a mad person. You think, oh, that's my niece. She feels very bad. She feels very bad that some people have come into this process and they have heard this knowledge and now they know. But because they're so weak, or because they are not following the science, not having proper association, or because of some things from the past that's weighing down on them, they're not working hard enough to get it out of them, and they go back to those patterns, now they actually suffer participation. When you're suffering, you know, I'm suffering because I took the initiation, and I made vows, and I'm taking drugs, I'm engaged in illicit sex, and I'm going against my guru, I'm going against the Vaishnavas, I made pledge before Krishna. You're suffering, and you know why you're suffering, and you're not ready to change. Or you're feeling that you are not ready to do it. At the same time, you want to and you don't want to, you try, but you're not determined. So many things, that is hell. I've never experienced it, I hope I never do, but just thinking about it, I can understand the hell that it must be. To be in a situation where you know that you are a cheater, your life is a lie, and you know that you are actually an embarrassment to the greatest mercy expansion of Krishna. So we have to all do our parts to keep people away from that. We keep people away from that by not getting caught up in other people's nonsense, whatever it may be. We're not overreacting to things. We're not underreacting. We don't go into denial, nor do we get frantic-y as if Krishna is not there. But we have sadness that people are not following, operating properly. We have sadness that people are going to suffer for their sins. And most important, we must live our lives in such a way that our life become our message. Greatest way to serve the Vaishnava community is to act like a Vaishnava. Can lecture, can write papers, can send emails here and there. The greatest way is to act as a Vaishnava in all circumstances. And so that people come around you, they have to act like Vaishnavas because your existence impels that, look, we're only going to do Vaishnava stuff. We're only going to talk Vaishnava things. And therefore, becomes the greatest offering. Reminding people, reminding oneself of what our particular commission is. But Maya has all of these ways. And so Vishwanath Thakurabhati is mentioning these anarthas and how they manifest. So offenses. So the Namaparad, Dhammaparad, Shavaparad, Vaishnavaparad, Guruaparad. Talk about these many times, so we won't go into kind of categorize each, looking at each thing too closely. But we have that in our mind, the mindset, different types of offenses. So then we go to the last category, which is called Bhakyudha, or Nathas coming from devotional service. What do we have? One, Anathas coming from sinful activities, past and present. Anathas coming from pious activities. Anathas coming from all different types of offenses. Then last we have anathas coming from the devotional service. What do we think those anathas are? Anybody have any idea? Anathas coming from devotional service. Somebody's in devotional service. We have any idea about that? Without addressing what we've already talked about, offenses, pious deeds, sinful acts, where anarth is coming from. Mm-hmm. Yes. Those are the type of anarthas. Pride.
Patishtasya, Puja, Labha. These are remember when Lord Chaitanya is cleaning the temple and he's doing the subtle stuff? This is what he's talking about. Siddhacharya, Divahimsa, Puja, Patishtasya. So these types of anarthas is a little more subtle. That the one is maybe even gotten beyond, transcended the others. Then we have to look really close about this too much desire for distinction, too much concern about adoration, and too much interest in pride. You've done something nice, done something wonderful, like this, like that. Therefore, you have this pride, condescending mood. So I've been there. I know this. And Maya says, okay, you've been there, you know this. But I got a special one for people like you. Maya thinking, yes. And a special way how to deal with you. You feel you have mastered me. You're not having the fear of me sufficiently. And so this can cause a problem. And it must, because there can be no imperfection in the spiritual world. So if we doing so much, but still we are too much thinking that we are responsible. We're too much thinking that we are to be glorified. Then that stuff has to go also. So then Maya arranges for Krishna a way to expose the situation of the person so that they can deal with this last type of anarthas. So these four types of anarthas we want to reflect on as we have a clear understanding of what to avoid. Then what happens is what's left. As we remove the unhealthy thing, what is left is the divine and the wonderful and the positive things. So, Śrīla Viṣvanātha Chakravarti goes on to explain some things about seva aparāt. Just in summary, he explains how chanting the Lord's name is so powerful that, and serving is so powerful that as we do some offenses, because basically everything we do has some offenses until we're pure, that it is not so serious that if we have good intent and we may not address in such a wonderful way the deities, but the heart and the mind is in the right place, the intent is there, we may forget to put the chamar in the hand or something. Just think of something hypothetical. Anyway, he's basically saying that these things are some slight obstacles, but they do not really cause any serious stagnation. That is, one is serving, especially going on chanting the holy name that Krishna receives and accepts. And it's like sometimes a child trying to do something, and he or she did not do it so expertly, but there was genuine good attention and love and concern. And so, even though the little painting that the child draw was kind of messy, but it was done as for one to receive and accept. And the person looks at it and is very happy about it. Such, even though it's still wet, the paint gets on their hand, but they're not disturbed. Huh? The pain is definitely there. It's on the hand. It's on their sari. It's on their dhoti. But it's not disturbance in that sense. The holy name of Krishna is all powerful and can absolve any offense, however serious. The offender may incorrectly think, if this is true about chanting, then why should I have to fall at the Vaishnava's feet? The emphasis is that when an offense is made to Vaishnavas, it's serious and one must beg the Vaishnava for forgiveness. And even if the Vaishnava is reluctant, one should keep on. But then one may think, well, if the chanting is so powerful in itself, then why should I even have to bother begging to a Vaishnava? After all, the scriptures ensure that for one who commits nama-aparāt, chanting is on its own will clear away all offenses. Henceforth, I shall certainly be again pardoned. So one thinks, I don't have to go and talk to the person. I don't even have to let them know that I'm the one who did that stuff. I'll just chant a little more serious, and I'll be freed from such. Vishwanath says, his Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti says, such thinking is incorrect. First, we understand that such thinking really shows the person is not really that feeling compunction or regret. They're not really ready to go and approach the person and beg forgiveness. It means they're not really feeling that sorry. They may feel a little disturbed that it happened and wish it wouldn't have happened. But if they really feel disturbed and sad by it and they want to be forgiven, then they should have the genuine humility to put themselves at the mercy to ask for forgiveness. But they just want to be freed of the reaction. So they just channel extra rounds. But doesn't get eradicated so easily like that. Instead, the offender becomes a mesh in another heinous nama-aparad. So, Srila Vishwanatha is saying that by one doing that, they actually now incur another aparad. Because they have made an aparad, and they recognize it as such, they're not really willing to go and beg the person. So there's big ego there, and lack of real sense of regret. But on top of it, they're thinking now, I'm just going to chant the holy name, and I'm going to clear myself. He says, now they're making another aparad because like they're using the holy name as they get for sinful activities. Or the idea of somebody who is sinning, they just got to clear up the holy name, they sin again. So what happens is that they will be more prone to again committing sin and then just thinking, I'm going to erase it by chanting. See, it acts as a deterrent also. When you offend someone and you have the responsibility for going humbly submitting yourself to that person. It can help you to think second, three, many times over about doing that offense again. As knowing that this is the way you get cleared from it. And the embarrassment, the anxiety that goes through sometimes having to deal with such. But if we just think, well, if I make some offense, I'll just chant, you know, a round and a half more Hare Krishnas and I'll be okay. And this is the seventh offense. Many sins on the strength of the holy name. So it's interesting how often one offense kind of fades off into another offense if we're not careful. And then it leads into the Guru Aparad. And this is happening now. You can see some people in some devotees' life, this is happening now. They've been so taking things for granted, making offenses, not honoring them, or making offenses and not having humility. But then later, it turns into Guru Aparad. So then they start doubting Srila Prabhupada. Then later it turns into Aparada Krishna. They doubt Krishna throughout the whole process. You'll see some patterns like that happening. Because it's science. It's inevitable. You work the science properly, certain things happen, you don't. And this is why these spiritual scientists are helping us to reflect on such. The offender may once again try to rationalize his behavior by saying, according to scriptures, now listen, we may all have used it sometimes. According to scriptures, Bhagavatam 11:11:29, only those who are compassionate, peaceful, and tolerant are called sadhus, or saintly persons. Therefore, the offense of blaspheming the devotee is appropriate only when someone possesses these characteristics. So one may think, well, yes, it's offensive to blaspheme or offend a sadhu, but that Mataji, she's not really a sadhu. That brahmachari, that devotee, that temple commander, he's not really a sadhu. So I don't really have to apologize to him. He's not a sadhu. It says to offend the sadhu. So one rationalizes. Or the dynamics is such that you offended somebody and then you go to apologize and they give you kind of a hard shoulder. And you sort of think, well, it's all over now. Because here I have done my necessary part and this person not even a sadhu anyway. So, you know, what can I do? But the scripture says that if somehow someone does not immediately accept, one should still approach and still try, still humble themselves. One should feel not that, oh, it's all over now. But they should feel, oh, how unfortunate I am. I made such an offense, and now this offense is trailing me, and I cannot even be forgiven for this. But one should think, let me try to approach in a more sincere way. Or let me use this as Krishna helped me to understand even better how serious my improper actions are. So now I have to think about it a little longer. They didn't forgive me so fast. So let me see also how to be able. So this is act as a deterrent. So I will not do the same thing again. Not that we deny the offense, or not that we just chant and say, okay, I'll clear myself. Or even that when we approach, we feel I've done my part. No, we still must still continue. So one or two other short things. It was a little late. I think I'll skip over some others so we can start off with a new chapter tomorrow. I'll just mention these things in passing. He talks about the jiva. That the jiva's position is that of eternal loving servitor of the Supreme Person. But he explains that there's two categories. First category being those under the spell of illusion and ignorance. Like humans, demigods, animals, lesser entities. The second kind are those who are free from meshes and illusions. And he divides them into two different categories. So he explains that there's these categories. One who is absorbed in the Lord's opulences. And then he breaks that down into categories. Anyway, this gets a little mind-boggling. we'll just mention this briefly. Those who are unattracted to the opulences, and this we can reflect on, are in two categories. Those who are into speculative knowledge, or those who engage in devotional service mechanically. Even though they are coming to the devotional process, even though they are experiencing some initial aspects of Bhakti Day, that it's mechanical, or they're too caught up in this mental speculation, there will be some stagnation, and the anattas will not be removed. The four anattas mentioned in the beginning of this chapter can be mitigated in five following ways. Okay, we talked about all of these different anattas in different ways. And now in the last few minutes, we just want to wrap up with how these anattas can be stopped. What to do? What is the natural process of how they gradually just fall to the side? So he gives five different issues, points, to deal with these four anattas that we just mentioned. So the first one is called Ekadasa Vrittini, which means in English, partially. The anatta is partially destroyed. Second is called Bohu Dasa Vrittini, substantially destroyed, freed, erased. Then Prayiki, almost completely, just about, almost gone. Purna, totally. And then last, Ayatiki, absolutely, thoroughly, where one has love of God. So we just scan through this briefly. The many anattas stemming from the aparats are partially destroyed in the final stages of bhajan kriya. Rendering, and this is engaged in devotional service under spiritual master, bhajan kriya. Now the bhajan kriya gains maturity. So when it's as we're going on in the process where we're developing taste, nishtha, steadiness, so at the point of partial destruction, then when there is steadiness in devotional service, then substantially destroyed. This state of development or the mitigating of anattas is substantially bahu dasaviti, or this is the platform of almost completely, where there's rati. Rati means, you know, genuine attraction, taste. Ruchi is very much there. So the unwanted desires in the heart are almost completely absolved. Then the prakriya, the third before the last, is the awakening of prema, or divine love. And then as this prema is established, it's completely destroyed. And so what's really happening then, to capitalize or to summarize this, what really goes on is that we're always pleasure seekers. And we're always engaged in activity. different types of exchanges and relationships, reflections, etc. So these improper things, they get moved to the side as we become more and more absorbed in the process of sadhana bhakti. As our faith is there, going with good sadhu association, sadhu sangha, we now participate in bhajan kriya, we engage in the regulative principles under good guidance and whatnot. And then gradually we develop this steadiness, and we develop taste, and it goes on and on. So it's like these things develop, and what happens is that the ecstasy, the realizations and the ecstasy burn up the weeds, the seeds, and then affect the environment so that the seeds cannot even be planted again. So there's always something going on. And what gradually happens is that the love, the ecstasy, before it turns into love, but it's a shadow, it's reflections, that becomes so much a part of one's being. It's like when a person becomes more Krishna consciousness, they have no desire to want to associate or tolerate any craziness. It's just so much out of their realm. You know, it's, you know, like my offering you a hamburger. No way. It's crazy. He said, well, you know, take it. It's a giant size here. What do you mean? Think, no way. You know? So the ecstasy is such that one becomes so enthused and full with such that other things have no interest. And what was there that was improper, it just burns it up. And then as it gets warmer, burnt away, then the atmosphere is clear, and then the creeper, the prema, the bhakti lata bija, now gets fully situated in prema. And such. It just simply means that which was lust has now really been converted to love. So now, beauty is that it was always there. The energy, the effect was always there. It just had to be converted. So the intensity is there. We discussed it some time back. We're always going to be mad. We're mad after what? Mad after Maya or mad for Krishna? So now, your channel has been adjusted now. And so where one was eating, sleeping, mating, defending for the big me, now one is doing it for Krishna. Where one was singing songs, hearing this, hearing that, reading the mundane literature, so many things, whatever. Now, it's all for Krishna. And so, as one has emptied themselves by allowing this creeper to develop and to push out other things, now these anarthas are not interfering. First it's partial, then it's almost complete, then it's complete, and then it's total absorption where they cannot even sneak in again, cannot even come back. And he ends with this chapter, I'll breeze right to the end because it's late, by giving some reflections on sometimes people thinking that even though one has seen Krishna, or has gotten the darshan of the Lord, or has advanced to the highest level, that one can still have sins following them from a previous life, or from an earlier time, or that one is still under the effects of some karma. But he explains that there are times when unusual things happen to advanced personalities. And he begins to explain that sometimes this is literally due to a special mercy, what Krishna takes away. Let me just read that slowly. What Krishna himself actually takes away as a way, really, to benedict that person. Even sometimes put them in poverty as a way to you bestow greater boons on them. Yashyaha, this is Bhagavatam 10.88.8. Yashyaham anuya harishe tat dana sanai. Tato dana taya yasya savgana dukha dukitam. The person who is blessed by me, I gradually take away his wealth, his friends, his relatives. They drift away from him because of his poverty and suffering. Another place the Lord says, Nihatva mago mat anuga lakshana. The awesome affliction known as poverty is in fact a sign of my mercy. So sometimes The kinship of Krishna just takes everything away. But it's not that one is experiencing from previous karma, from sins in the past, of any nature, seeds or the sins, but is due to some special benediction. So we can reflect on that as we get ready for tomorrow's discussion, as we look at the fifth wave. We see this wonderful message that Śrīla Viśvanātha is offering to us. That is not really something different from what we are finding with so many of the other acharyas and teachings. No, it's all the same. But different great servants of the Lord have their own ways of expressing their love for humanity and their doing their services to their spiritual masters. But we see that the Maya, whether it's Maya in this millennium or next millennium, whether it's Maya so many, many millenniums in the past, it's the same Maya. Surfaces in so many different ways. So it's not a secret or a mystery about how Maya comes out. Or is there a mystery on how to counteract the Maya? And that's one of the really beautiful things about Krishna consciousness, is that we have this constant living history. We're not just reading Bhagavad Gita, thinking about, oh, Arjuna, he's pretty far out, Krishna's pretty far out. It's nice about this epic and what they used to do then and how they did it. No. Even though it's a long time back, even though some of these pastimes, other yugas, etc., other lifetimes of Lord Brahma, but still, is ever fresh, ever available for us, in that sense. Any questions or any comments? Pastor Michael.
Gurudev, in our relationship with different devotees, sometimes the relationships improve, but it could be from us improving, or it could be from the opposite person improving. So how would we keep from thinking that we are the one that improved?
Yeah, nice question. If I ever said these deep philosophical questions, explain this simple way. Yes, this was one of the issues we've been discussing about pride. Or the first thing we talked about, mercy and effort. That one shouldn't think, oh, just see how nice I grabbed the rope. Or one shouldn't think, oh, just how wonderful I am that I changed this person. Just see. No, we must be careful. To always approach things with a sense of humility. Especially when we're successful. Or especially when we are achieving. And it's even more important that we approach it with humility. It's a little easier to have humility when, you know, you're getting smacked in the face. Or when, you know, things are not happening the way you like. Or some misfortunes. It's a little kind of easier to be a little humble. Because you can, it is more obvious that one is not in control. So it can bring a certain natural humility. But when we do seem to be in control, the illusion is there, it's very strong, and it's even more dangerous. And that's why sometimes it's very hard for rich people often to take to spiritual life, because someone who's not suffering so much and has a lot of power, money, to make things happen, they have more sometimes the mindset that, why do I need to take shelter of God? I mean, I just pay for this, do that. Let me use my contacts. So that those opulences or that wealth then becomes that third category, where pious deeds or benefits from the past become the greatest obstacles. So we're having some type of relationship with someone, but things weren't going so well, or there's been some arguments or some problems, and now, you know, it's been resolved. We shouldn't think, well, how wonderful I was. I just tolerated the person, now they've changed. Or how wonderful it was, I finally get them straight. You know, I'm really a sadhu. I'm a good philosopher also. But we should think that, you know, how fallen I am that the whole issue came up in the first place. And how wonderful it is that now that we can relate better, and how much is based on Srila Prabhupada's mercy that we have been brought together in this way. Or how horrible I am, let me be careful that I don't let this thing happen again with someone else. You have that kind of humility, you know, life moves fast for us. We're much more happier and fixed in our devotion. We won't have this last category, you know, of the anatta, the puja, the pratishtasya, which is, you know, that on those last snares. You're situated properly, things are going on, you're involved in it, productivity is happening, results is happening. But now, although all these wonderful things is going on, one is claiming the proprietorship. So this will bring a person back down again. Yes.
Two questions. The first one is when you were talking about the offenses against the devotees.
Yes.
And some time ago, one devotee, we were talking and I asked him if a certain devotee was offended by something. And he said, well, he's a Vaishnav. He's not offended. But it didn't really make sense to me because I was thinking, even if he's not offended, is that there'd still be some reaction because Krishna is seeing that an offense is being made towards
exactly.
him. Is there still something happening?
Yeah, offense was made. The person may be a Vaishnava, and he did not or she did not personally accept it, but offense has been registered in that person who offended in his name or her name. And so they are offended. You know, the person who they offended may not accept it in that sense. Even has become humbled by it. Sees it as their fault. But Lord in the heart has marked it as an offense. And that person is going to pay dues for it, is accountable for it.
And the other one was, I didn't really understand. At the end you were talking about the leading of the different anarthas, and the last two was when it's completely and then absolutely thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really understand the difference because and how if
it's sort of like the point of no return, the point where completely absolutely thoroughly, where one has been completely accepted by Krishna. One is completely in blissful exchange in their original sarup or conscious of that. And there's no question of any deviation, any turn back, any lack of absorption, and just only for Krishna. One is all for Krishna, Krishna is all for that person.
When it's gone, but you're not, you can always turn back.
Oh, it's gone, but it's gone, but it's not fully blossomed. Has been blossomed to its highest height.
Okay. Thank you.
Any last question?
And then the results of these offenses or not to.
Yes.
Can we understand that this is also the Lord's mercy when the reaction comes?
Yes.
So we can understand that this is the Lord's mercy also. So
it's a mercy, but in the sense that when you put your hand in fire and it gets burnt, it's an indicator to you that the fire is hot, that it's dangerous. And you're dealing with the pain from that. But that's also mercy, that it helps us to understand what the effects of that situation is. So the mercy is, hopefully you won't put your hand in the fire again.
Because when the result is, when we're recipient of a mistake or something that we've been doing wrong,
mm-hmm.
And so how can we bring ourselves to actually desire to correct this, to really come to grips with it. In other words, rather than say, boy, yeah, I just really got kicked by Maya, and then just kind of brush it off.
That's where the devotee's own actions, speech is there also. But some people can only learn from the failure, and from the whipping, and from the hard knocks. You know, some things we definitely learn from hearing, some things we learn from seeing, and some things we can very much appreciate as we interpolate and can understand and we move on. There are certain things, experience may be there, and especially where one is dull or there's stagnation, then one learns more from experience. And that's a slow way, and that's a difficult way. And it's also a dangerous way. But some people, this is how they learn. And Krishna knows that. And so he himself is allowing people to learn in different ways. But again, it's like we said earlier. We still shouldn't say, well, it's karma. That person is only going to learn when they really get smashed. So I just want to be around and see how they deal with niggas smashed. No, it's still that we still should do our part. But at the same time, we understand. If somebody is not changing and they go on and they have this experience and they get chastised this way, we know that it is karma. And see, we know it because we know that Krishna will always provide the help if we really want it. As we're making offenses and we really don't want to, Krishna will provide a way that we can know that we're offending so we can stop. But if we don't have this genuine ID card where we really, really want to not do it, then, you know, we'll not change until we're in a situation where it's really forced upon us. And then some people, even then, still don't change. So the worst case is that when that happens, and then even when they get chastised, they don't change, but they blame everybody else. They find a way to blame. And when one does like that, it's only a matter of time before Radharani just moves them out. They become a Buddhist or something. Yes.
I was just thinking about a little bit of Vishwanatha Chakravarti's life, and there's an example of him demonstrating how to deal with pride, in that he explained that he was serving in one school, and he was getting all this, I guess, aggrandizement from the people in the village, and he realized he said that he felt that he was getting prideful because of the people that were just glorifying him in this village. So he had to leave that place. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking in terms of my own prideful nature, how in order to leave that place of pride, it seems that the activities has to manifest first for me to understand that that's actually a prideful activity. And so I guess the question is, how does one work on this pride without having to, as you just answered that question, let something have to manifest in our life and feel the pain and have to be chastised and all that before we can actually deal with it?
We just have to appreciate others more. We really appreciate other Vaishnavas more. It was a question of pride. The pride deals with some condescending mood. We have too much pride. It means we're condescending. We're thinking that we're better than others, which means we're thinking others are low. And so if we just have better genuine feelings for others, then there'll always be less and less pride. And we're not, then the other side happens. Then Krishna, you know, smashes us. Because when we're chanting and we're trying, we're holding on to some improper stuff, then Krishna helps us because we keep calling, saying, dear Krishna, please use me, engage me in your service, help me. And so if the obvious ways he's trying to help, we're not receiving it, then that's when he smashes us, his way to help us. But the main thing is just having greater appreciation for others. That's a nice note to end on, because so many of the Nartas and so many aparads and offenses and weak and all these things, one doesn't really have to actually know them specifically, not really. I mean, it's good to force to understand and try to appreciate. But if we just have greater appreciation for sadhus, these things will not enter into one's consciousness. And when there is an issue, it'll be easily eradicated because there's genuine appreciation. And when there's not, we can do a lot of mechanical things. We can even offer apologies, but we won't really mean it. And we'll do something similar or even worse later, because we won't really be respecting and honoring that person's existence. So we're thinking more kind of a karma conic way. Maybe I made an offense, so I better try to clear myself in case I made an offense, so I can be a greater devotee. But it's not really a real appreciation while we made apology. But as we really honor another person's existence, then we're careful to avoid something, doing something that's improper. And we do something that's improper, we really have a sense of regret. We come to it in that mood. And then Krishna gives us the intelligence and how to avoid it in such ways. Okay. ISKCON found the charge, his divine grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada ki, Radha Damodar ki.